The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Martin Wainwright, and this is The Guardian's Focus podcast. Nothing has yet been contrived by man by which so much happiness is produced as by a good tavern or inn. So said Dr. Johnson in 1776. But in 2010, pubs in Britain are closing at a rate of around 30 a week. Buffeted by recession, the rising cost of beer, the smoking ban, and fiercer than ever competition from supermarkets, it's never been more challenging to work behind a bar. This month saw another blow. A programme that was due to give financial assistance to community-run pubs was axed. Over the next half hour, we'll hear from owners, brewers, publicans and patrons to find out what's happening to one of the country's oldest institutions. And it's by no means all doom and gloom. We come to White Locks, which is a very, very famous bar in the centre of Leeds. Its official title is the First City Luncheon Bar, but nobody calls it that, I don't think. And I'm just going to ask some of the customers in the alley outside who are drinking, what brings you to White Locks?
A few drinks with friends from work.
And it's got that kind of atmosphere that's nice?
Yeah, just traditional, typical Yorkshire for me.
Interesting you say traditional. I mean, how would you define that? I'm sorry to be a bit schoolmastery, but...
Not trendy, very cask ales, nice pub food, nice atmosphere.
No, it seems very nice and friendly, you know. Early doors, but yeah, so far so good.
And you've got a glass of wine, but you've got a glass of beer.
Lager. I'm not on the local hours yet. So yeah, we'll warm up to those in a bit.
Choice is really good, isn't it? That's to just can we have a glass of wine, beer? You know, you can fetch people here, and no matter what they drink, it doesn't matter because they can.
And the weather's so nice in Leeds, you can be outside.
Perfect, isn't it, really? Yes, can't go wrong with that. Yeah, it is, yes. Yeah, I left the rain, yes.
I'm not like a connoisseur of beer as such, but I just come here for like the friendly atmosphere, the Yorkshire folk. It's just like really friendly. It doesn't matter what you drink. I mean, I know a lot of people come here for like the traditional pulled ale and things like that, but...
I mean, I live in Germany. I'm Croatian, actually. Mm-hmm. But so my brother-in-law just said, oh, this is a nice place here.
Yes.
So let's just go for a beer.
And so, are you pleased with what you found, kind of thing?
Yeah, it's nice, really nice. Yeah.
I mean, in Germany they have Gasthäuser, and you know, yeah. Germany is very famous for beer as well. But is there something? Do you find something particular about the English pub? I mean, English people go on about the English pub, but do you think it's that different?
You get a bigger different like choice of beers. Like in Germany, let's say you go to your local pub, you get maybe four or five different kinds of beer. And if you go to England, it doesn't matter where you are, north, south, you get like at least 10 different kinds of beer.
White Locks is thriving, but that's not the case elsewhere, especially in the countryside where traditional pubs are having a tough time. And with government support being withdrawn for community-centred ventures, maybe the future of pubs is more like this. They call this vertical drinking. Pubs like this, of which there are many in the centre of Leeds, have huge standing capacity but not very many seats. The idea is to maximise profit and minimise costs. That means quick service, big brand lagers that they can rely on selling in large volume.
You come here because we get off a bus right next to where we work, and it's just convenient to come in somewhere. It's like near interchange to anywhere in Leeds, so it's just kind of a place you go. So
is it? I mean, I imagine Wetherspoons, it's quite good value, is it, compared to some?
Yeah. It's just like they've got more buying power, haven't they? There's more chains, so they've got obviously get things at a cheaper rate. So
yeah.
I mean, if you're really out there just to think, right, I'm going to finish work and do it as cheap as possible, you'd probably go to like Tiger and stuff like that, because they do like happy hours, like two for ones. And
how much, I mean, a pint there would cost what, do you reckon?
I've never been, but I've heard a rumour it's probably about £2 or something like that. Exactly. You know, just or two for one, is it?
Tiger, yeah. I think it's half price happy hour until 9:30, Monday to Friday.
So it's almost getting down to like the level of supermarket drink?
Yeah, near enough. Which nothing will compete with, because the breweries sell to them even cheaper, but if you're going to go out and socialise and drink, places like that are the way to go if you're going out on a mission.
But how did the British pub, so admired by Dr. Johnson, turn into this? Until 1989, a handful of breweries owned most of Britain's pubs. Then Margaret Thatcher's government introduced legislation known as the Beer Orders in an attempt to aid competition and break the hold of the powerful brewers. Paul Kingsnorth explored what happened next in his recent book, Real England.
Because it was now illegal for a particular brewer to own more than 2,000 pubs, what the brewers did was they conspired to create standalone pub companies which didn't brew any beer at all. They then sold all of their pubs to these pub companies, and the pub companies bought all of their beer from the brewers. So what you actually got was a situation in which pub companies were created, which didn't brew beer, they just owned pubs, but they owned almost as many pubs as the brewers did today. And what the situation we're back in today is that all of those big brewers have now pretty much disappeared from the scene, but we've got three big pub companies instead who actually own more pubs between them than the brewers did. And the situation arguably is worse, because at least the brewers had an interest in keeping pubs as pubs, because they made and sold beer. So they wanted to keep the pubs open, even though they wanted to get as much money out of them as possible. But a pub company primarily actually is a property company, and is a property company which is floated on the stock market. So what you've got is a company that owns lots and lots of pubs and needs to produce increasing returns for shareholders. Now, a pub, when it's well run in a good area, can certainly make a living for a landlord, but it's going to have great difficulty producing year-on-year profits that keep increasing over time. So it's often more profitable for a pub company these days, or it particularly was up until the recession anyway, to try and run a pub down and get permission to turn it into a house and sell it off for an inflated property price. And that's what's been going on in a lot of the country. And when they don't do that, what pub companies do is they screw the landlords into the ground by doing two things. Firstly, they regularly increase the rent on a lot of these pubs. And secondly, what they have is something called a beer tie, which is what the old brewers used to have as well. And if you rent a pub as a landlord from a pub company, what you will do is you will have to sign a contract which says that you have to buy most or all of your drinks from that pub company. And they will often charge about twice as much as you will get from, say, the cash and carry or direct from the brewer. So you have a situation now in which, despite this 1989 legislation that was supposed to break up the monopolies of big companies owning pubs, we've got a lot of big companies owning pubs. They don't make beer. They don't necessarily have an interest in pubs. What they do need to do, what they do have an interest in, primarily is profit making. And if you talk to pretty much any landlord from a big pub company pub, they will have the same complaints about the ever increasing rents and about the beer tie.
But is he right to blame the pubcos, the pub companies, for the parlous state of the industry? Susie Jackson is the letting and recruitment director of Britain's largest pub company, Punch Taverns.
I think people who are from outside of the industry would probably get confused with all the different messages, and a lot of what is said in the criticism is presented in a way that is not necessarily representative of the truth. I think people need to understand that for pub landlords like Punch, there is absolutely no incentive for us to see a pub fail. So whenever we offer a deal to somebody, it is with the absolute transparency of letting them know how much they are likely to earn in that pub, what we believe the turnover of that pub should be, and how we come to offer the rent that we charge for that particular pub. And it's all based around the partner making a significant amount of money as well, and certainly enough money. It's all relative to the pub. But there's an absolute relationship with beer price and rent, and people cannot talk exclusively about one or the other. So if you have got high rents, then you've a high rent on a pub, then the reality is you've probably got significantly higher discounts. Whereas if you're being charged a wholesale price for your beer, so you're being charged more and not receiving as much discount, you're probably paying much lesser of a rent. And people tend to focus on one or the other, but there's a direct relationship between them. And like I say, you know, all of our deals are structured in a way that we can present very transparently how we've come to offer that deal, and also take feedback if people think that's not realistic. But it's a low-cost entry business, and frankly, it's a really good way of starting your own small business, and with particularly low ingoing.
That was Susie Jackson of Punch Taverns. I've come to the Shoulder of Mutton in Kirby Overblow. It's run by Dave Deacon, and he's one of an increasing number of publicans who are breaking out of the traditional pub mould. The Shoulder of Mutton is also the local shop.
We sell everything. We sell meat and fish, fruit and veg, freshly baked bread, all the essentials, you know, milk, butter, sugar.
And things like stamps and stuff.
And yes, stamps, cigarettes, albeit on a very small scale. We're not going to stop people going to Sainsbury's, but what we are going to do is prevent them from having to drive 4 miles either way to get to the nearest shop.
Because until you opened this up, there wasn't anything.
And it's in its second year now, and it's growing really well. We're, the figures for its second year are much improved on its first.
There's a similar venture here at my next stop in the village of Bagby near Thirsk. All the villagers I spoke to were very much in favour of the extras which are now being provided by the Bagby Inn since Victoria and Patrick Brizio moved in last September with their three children.
The village did have a shop several years ago, but once that shop closed, our nearest shops were actually in Thirsk itself. So to have a have access to emergency provisions like bread, eggs, milk, things that you need often quite quickly, is wonderful. And also the fact that they encourage activities in it within the pub.
So yes, you mentioned it sounded like they almost run a bit of a youth club, because that's another thing. I mean, that's maybe putting it a bit strongly, but I often meet young people who live in country villages and they always say, you know, there's nothing to do.
Well, I have two boys, the eldest one sort of in his teens, so I think for them to have the opportunity to go and play pool when in the quieter hours, sort of immediately after school, before sort of 7 o'clock on an evening or whatever, I think is good that they've got the opportunity to do that.
Yes, yeah, it's very helpful. They do nice meals and everything, so, and they're very nice people that they mix in and they talk to you, whereas some landlords will just ignore you and...
Because it's nice to have a pub, isn't it? I mean, they're doing these other things, but some villages now, you go in and the pub's shuttered and because beer's so, drink's so cheap in the supermarket.
Well, that's the problem with a lot of village pubs are closing for that reason. Mm-hmm. Also, the smoking ban, that killed a lot of pubs off.
Yes, and of course, it's difficult for people to drive now unless somebody agrees to be the one who's not going to have anything.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the police are all the time watching, so you can't risk it and drink and drive.
Do you think... Are there any things that they don't do that you'd like to suggest to them that they could add? I mean, obviously the couple who run it are very enterprising pair.
There's nothing that I think of, because this year we've got darts, pool and everything back in the pub, dominoes. So last year it was away because they've just taken over and the last couple didn't want it. They weren't interested in darts and thing, which I think you need in winter months to keep a pub going.
It's enterprises like the Bagby Inn and the Shoulder of Mutton that are being held up by some as a model for saving rural pubs. John Longdon is the director of Pub is the Hub, a scheme backed by the Prince of Wales that helps advise communities on running viable local pubs. He says they're being put to ever more surprising uses.
I think the initial unusual one we had was the use for church services. And they then found that the church... services were so popular because, of course, surprise, surprise, everybody can stay and meet behind for a bit of socialising. So that was while the church roof was being repaired. But little simple things, as well as the cooking of school meals, which, of course, then attracts the grandparents and the parents to the pub itself because they want to know how on earth is little Johnny suddenly eating broccoli for the first time in his life. And I honestly had a nightmare when school meals came up because I had this awful image of the press would hound us with little five-year-olds with pints of mild in their hand. But it didn't work out that way. And it's very good because, of course, it supports all your local suppliers. But what's been happening recently is a huge demand all of a sudden for allotments that suddenly villagers are finding that they want to grow vegetables and surprise, surprise, the one property that maybe has a spare half an acre or an acre happens to be the local village pub. And particularly in Wales, it's becoming quite a phenomenon of providing allotments. So heaven knows what will happen next. I mean, playgrounds happen, as I say, community centres happen, all sorts of things that the local community just wish they had or wish they hadn't lost.
Does it affect the traditional attractions of the pub? I mean, if you've got too many five-year-olds eating broccoli or other activities taking place, like, you know, if the shop comes rather dominant or the hymns are sung too loudly, is there a risk that the essence of the English pub will be lost?
No, I don't think it has, because joking aside, obviously the school meals were being transported to the schools themselves, so the children aren't actually having a school meals in the pub. And certainly church services were there and in fact brought a stronger trade to the pub at lunchtime. So no, we don't see a conflict, because what normally happens is it's an outside building such as the old stable block or the barn that is actually converted. And the great attraction that often a pub has is it has a readily available car park. So the two are often separated. It's very rare, although it does happen, that you will find that almost the village shop has been put next to the bar. Although in one situation in Lincolnshire, I met the local doctor when I called in there one night, and he thought it was marvellous because he could say to his wife suddenly at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, "Darling, would you like a tin of crab or something getting?" And he would find as the most marvellous excuse to be able to shoot down the pub, have a drink and do his shopping and get some brownie points and get back. So it does create quite a supportive and jolly interest overall. But we've not heard of it conflicting. And I think if a licensee felt it was going to conflict, then they probably wouldn't do it. Because they've got to be supportive in the first place.
John Longdon there of the campaign group Pub is the Hub. Well, so far we've heard from punters and publicans, but there's one part of the story that we're missing. Breweries, where the beer is actually made, have seen their power in the industry gradually diminish. But Theakston's of Massham, here in North Yorkshire, went from independence to ownership by FTSE-listed Scottish and Newcastle, and now back to independence. And we're here where it all happens, in the brewery, which is home to the famous Theakston's Old Peculiar Ale, with Mr. Simon Theakston himself.
You can go into pubs sometimes, especially in beautiful parts of the world like here in North Yorkshire, and you'll see a wonderful array of choice there on the beer. And,
well, in terms of beers on the bar, you mean?
Exactly. Yeah. And they'll have guest beers and that kind of thing. But then there are other pubs where it just seems to be very sadly limited. Why is that?
Well, that's possibly it depends. I mean, it's a rather loaded question, to be honest.
Well, it may not be sad. I mean, if it's your beer, then it's not sad.
But I think in many ways it may be a reflection of the structural part of the industry. I mean, if I own a pub, I'm also a brewer, I would expect that pub just to sell my beer. Mm-hmm. And I think people would think that's fairly reasonable. And so those pubs that sell just beers from one brewery, the chances are it's actually owned by that brewery, and that's fair enough. But as it happens in modern Britain today, we're seeing a resurgent interest in traditional English ales, and people like choice and variety, and there's an infinite number of variety tastes and styles of English ale. And so it would be a sensible licensee to bear that in mind when it comes to choosing what beers you have on the bar. And if it's a free house, if the pub is actually owned by the licensee, he'd be very well advised to make sure that there's a wide variety of cask ales, not necessarily all from the same brewery, to meet his customer demand.
And does that apply, do you think, to... It seems to me sometimes there are two... Well, there are lots of different types of pubs, but there are two big categories. One is the lovely country pub, where you sit down and there's been a revolution in food and entertainment, gardens, things for children and so on. And then in cities like my own one, Leeds, you get these places where people just stand and pour it down themselves, you know. But from the brewer's point of view, is there a difference there, or you'll be supplying to both those outlets?
We supply to both those outlets, and the thing about pubs is that they are the ultimate niche brand, and no two pubs are the same. They all do a slightly different job. You don't take one's wife... One wouldn't take one's wife necessarily to a city centre bar in Leeds.
No.
But you might take her to a lovely country pub to have some supper or lunch together. And therefore, there are pubs, the common denominator, providing two roles. And so it really depends. The role of a pub depends on where it's situated, how people use it, and so on. But the critical thing is that wherever your pub happens to be, whether it's a city centre or in a rural community, it has to have high standards, because people today expect very high standards from pub retailing. Drinking in pubs is no longer a matter of something that you have to do to replenish fluids. It is a matter of choice. It's a personal part of one's leisure time activities. And we have to compete in that marketplace. And there are a lot of other competing attractions in the leisure market in which pubs have to compete. And the absolute start point is to make sure that your pub is run professionally to a very high quality standards, providing choice, not just drink, but also food as well, wherever possible, just to compete with other attractions.
The poet and essayist Hilaire Belloc once wrote, "When you've lost your inns, drown your empty selves, for you will have lost the last of England." But England has not yet lost its inns, and as we've heard, there's still plenty to be hopeful for. Paul Kingsnorth again.
There's still a lot of free houses in the country. there's a rise in community pubs. One of the good things that the coalition government said it was going to do when it got into power was continue a fairly recent piece of legislation that Labour had put in, which created a fund to help communities buy out their pubs. And it seems they're going to abolish that, which is a very silly thing to do, in my view. But there are still a lot of free houses around. There's a rise in community pubs. And I think over the last few years, there's been a recognition of what's happening with the disappearance of pubs, because pubs have been disappearing over the last couple of decades faster than any time in British history. And I think that people have realised their value. And there's a landlord's campaign going on at the moment, which a lot of landlords seem to be breaking ranks and getting involved in, which is an attempt to get the beer tie abolished, which would mean that pub companies can no longer insist that landlords buy all of their beer. Now, if that were to happen, it would take a fairly simple piece of legislation, for example, that could really change the playing field. Another thing that could really change the playing field pretty easily was if the government decided to crack down on some of the sharp practices of the pub companies, which, again, it could do. If the Thatcher government could do it, I don't see why this lot can't. So I don't think traditional pubs are doomed at all, but I think that if we're going to make them work, we simply need more people going into them, and we need more people drinking in them, and we just need, as a country, a recognition of their importance, because a pub has been kind of at the centre of English and of British culture for thousands and thousands of years. It's the institution of the ordinary people. It's just where people go to talk and drink and have fun. It always has been. I don't see it disappearing, but we need to start seeing the pub as a community resource instead of a profit-making centre.
John Longdon looks ahead.
I think we will go through a period where we will see more closures. And there have been forecasts of anywhere between another 5,000 to 8,000 closures. And that is being brought about by the huge, wide variety of challenges, whether it be alcohol pricing in supermarkets, whether it be the smoking ban, whether it be the change of social priorities. People go out these days to eat out probably more than to drink. The availability of good food and good wine and good beer at home. The whole social dimension is changing, and I think we have to recognise that. So I think more pubs will close. You could say that a lot jolly well should, because I think as anybody drives round, they'll still see quite a few rough old boozers, if they're actually honest with themselves, that they can't imagine how it ever imagines to stay open in today's market. And I sometimes think until that you know, rough old boozer that we all know, until that one's closed, then I think we'll have reached the bottom. The sad thing is, 5 years ago, it was the alternate use value for a change of use to residential that was threatening pubs. Today, I think we've got to look at it wider as an industry and say, why are pubs closing? Is there any way we can help support pubs to be more profitable so they can stay open? Because that is the big, big threat. But I think once you're through that closure programme, I'm still optimistic that the good pubs will survive.
Simon Theakston, how he sees pubs developing from now on.
There are very few places in our society where two people can meet on a completely flat playing field with no debarring of any reason for banning to go into that pub in the first place, where they can talk. As long as you've got enough for a half a pint of beer, you can talk to a duke or a dustman side by side. And it's the act of humanity, it's the act of being with other people that make being a human what we are. I always think that the prospect of a curry and a night in is far greater than the reality. Because invariably, when you buy your curry and you watch your film, there's always a sense of anticlimax. Yet, on the other hand, if you say to your wife, your partner, your friends, let's go out for a pint on a rainy, wet Monday evening, the prospect is pretty grim. But invariably, you have a far, far better time than you anticipated. And the reason why is because you're with other people. It's the act of humanity, which is at the core and the essence of the pub in Britain. And because of that, it will always ever succeed.
Well, that's all from me in Yorkshire. I'm Martin Wainwright. The producer was Phil Maynard. Thanks for listening. And cheers. Very nice too.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.